today in Studio 360. After Walter Martin's band, The Walkmen, broke up, he had to find a new approach to songwriting.
You know, I'd never really done that before, try to just be myself entirely.
Walter Martin plays live right here. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start the show, 2016 has barely gotten started, and already my pal Samantha Hunt's new novel, Mr. Splitfoot, is one of my favorite books of the year. The novel is fantastic and fantastical. Part ghost story, part twisted tale of a cult, part crazy road trip. It's about love and motherhood and the wish we all have to make sense of the senseless. The book follows Ruth and Nat, 17-year-old orphans raised by an abusive zealot at an orphanage. The place is called Love of Christ! Exclamation point. The kids' great comfort is their knack for talking to the dead. Then, a decade or so later, more or less in the present day, Ruth and her niece Cora, who is single, pregnant, and adrift, make their way across upstate New York on a mysterious quest. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what was the germ of this story?
I think... So, I'd have to say that the earliest stirrings of this book happened when I was about 6 years old, and... there's a ghost story in it, The Vanishing Hitchhiker, which probably everybody knows.
Well, there are many ghost stories.
Many ghost stories in the book.
One.
But that one in particular, which when I was 6 years old, Honeycomb cereal printed on the back of the cereal box a copy of that that you could cut out for Halloween. And I cut it out. And I'd say that was probably the earliest start of this book. So, you know, 38 years later.
So sugary cereal and and being spooked.
And
came
being
together.
Scared. Being scared. Yep.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So that memory of that cereal box 30 odd years ago inspired you to write this book?
I began with that story. I was also at the time pregnant with twins, and I really just wanted to go for a long walk, and I actually couldn't. I mean, I really couldn't even walk to the end of my driveway being pregnant with twins. And so for me, a lot of the book was during that pregnancy, just this idea of, wow, oh, walking is the ultimate freedom. Just leaving your house one day and not coming back. That seemed amazing to me.
Which happens in the book. And it really germinated out of the twins germinating in you, essentially.
Yes.
And speaking of twins, I mean, I've always thought getting pregnant is the most supernatural thing that can happen to a human being in real life. Twins is like really supernatural.
Absolutely. And that would say is the third story here that started the book, is the idea of motherhood. And I had a 2-year-old and found out that I was 4 months pregnant with twins. And so motherhood came on really, really hard for me, I'd say, very, very swiftly. Not hard in you know, I love it, obviously.
Sure.
But hard in, came down heavy in a big way. And approaching the book, like, things that I'd heard about motherhood were so cliche and so wrong and so not my experience.
Give me an example.
That it's about making broccoli and chicken breasts. It's about driving a minivan.
Eventually, it's all that, too.
But much of it,
the deep, weird,
what you said, the total supernatural phenomenon of making a person in your body, and then the person starts talking to you.
Yes.
My kids are older now, and I can't believe it.
Will you read a bit from Mr. Splitfoot before we talk more?
Sure. So this is where Ruth and Nat meet for the first time when they're quite young. Ruth's sister, Elle, has aged out of the group home, and she is replaced with Nat. Ruth said nothing for 2 weeks. No one noticed. Eventually, the state brought the father a replacement, a boy named Nat who'd had trouble with matches and kerosene. The word became flesh and lived among them. "You can be my sister now," Ruth told him. That was the word. Nat was also 5, small enough to stuff inside the tall white garbage bag of clothes he carried. "All right," he agreed. "Sisters." Nat moved into the room Ruth had shared with Elle. Didn't even change the sheets. One twin bed. They slept foot to face. 2 heads on 1 body, joined like a knave card, sisters. Ruth grew, Nat grew. The bed stayed small. Her hair got longer. His beauty sharpened like a vampire's. And while the father was distracted by meditations on his messiahhood, fantasizing his interview with Rolling Stone magazine and Oprah, some dewy bridge, a bundled corpus callosum, metastasized between the person of Nat and the person of Ruth.
That was Samantha Hunt reading from her novel, Mr. Splitfoot. So the two stories of you know, a little time ago, these two friends, boy and girl, and then more or less present day, one of them grown up and her niece, they play out side by side in alternating chapters. Originally, you wanted to have them be independent demi-books bound together, and you'd read one and then the next?
Yeah. No, so you would start one book on this side, read one chapter, flip the book over.
Also, it would be read the same way.
Read the same way, uh-huh. But in the process of flipping the book so that both books would meet in the middle and end in the middle. I like that idea simply because when I was young, I was a bookmaker. And
Literally a bookmaker.
Yeah, an actual
you
bookmaker.
You didn't take bets.
In artist books. No. Oh, yeah. I wish. In my next life, that's going to be the bookmaking I'll do. And both narratives are climbing up a mountain in the Adirondacks. And I thought, oh, that's a lovely image of them meeting in the middle of this mountain.
And you decided it was too tricky and stunty, or just it was too hard to do?
Publishing house decided it was too tricky and stunty.
Uh-huh.
No, I still have fantasies of it being printed that way someday.
The older version of Ruth, who begins as this kid in half the book and then is old, is mute. Why did you want a character who didn't speak?
The idea to make her mute came out of a deep interest I have in the singer Linda Thompson and how she lost her voice after her—
In like the 80s?
When she and Richard Thompson were breaking up, she lost her voice, couldn't sing for 11 years. Also, my great-grandmother lost her voice for her entire life. Her first child died, and she never spoke again for, 60 years. And so that idea of a mute woman, a silent woman, and what that means, I mean, there's many examples. Maya Angelou lost her voice for years when she was a child after trauma. And I thought, oh, wow, that voiceless woman is very powerful to me. And I set myself the challenge. What if I could create a character who can't talk? How would she communicate in a book?
Well, you set yourself a lot of challenges in this book, like the religious sect you invent called the Etherists, where you not only invented their religion, but wrote their holy text.
I did. I made up the religion. As I started to do the research for this book, I had recently left the city, moved upstate to upstate New York, and I started researching all the different religions that had started there, Mormonism, spiritualism.
The big Shaker community nearby.
The Shaker community, the Millerites. There's so many religious communities in upstate New York.
No, the 19th century in upstate New York was a place of miracles, wonders, and insane people.
But I love that about it. I love the kind of aspirational Americanism of that.
Yep.
It feels like capitalism to me in terms of religion. And I think that there's something humorous about that.
Yes.
And I said, I'm going to try to do what Joseph Smith did and borrowed from the Book of Mormon to create the Book of Ether, borrowed from Carl Sagan's Cosmos, another person who inspired me a lot as a child. And so I kind of just thought, why don't take everything that I love? I'll take my fascination with Mormons. I'll take my love of vinyl records. I'll take,
you can be random
Carl Sagan.
Too.
Yeah, I'll take Carl Sagan and see if I can build a religion around these things that I value. And the idea of the meteorites. I studied geology in undergrad, so I love...
The whole part of the book is about how the meteorites that have fallen in New York and how they have been mysteriously mapped in a way that I won't talk about.
That was fun, too, to think about the meteorites, because quite frankly, when I went to the meteorites, I selected them as something that seemed entirely random. And I wanted to hold that up scientifically against religion. Look at this random pattern. Why are you making meaning out of it? And then
what humans, especially American humans, do.
But then I couldn't believe it when I actually did look at the map and they were all aligned along the Erie Canal and the Hudson River. And I thought, oh no, this is proving me wrong.
Well, let's look at cause and effect there. But anyway, so once you were in upstate New York and discovered or the wealth of this history of new religions and sects and all that in the 19th century, that was part of the what prompted you to tell this story and set it there?
Yeah, I made a visit to Lilydale, the spiritualist community there, and that was completely inspiring. It's a Victorian era summer camp where you go in the summer and people talk to the dead. And my favorite part of Lilydale is there's an outdoor amphitheater called Inspiration Stump, and twice daily they bring in mediums. And the mediums just start channeling to whoever is there. And it's almost like an auction. I mean, it's kind of like, all right, I'm talking to Stephen. Wait, no, Stephen? Okay, here's Sophia. Does anybody have a Sophia out there who you're looking for? And it was amazing to me because I have to confess that as a writer of fiction, I identify with the con artistry of that practice.
Assuming they are also speakers of fiction.
Yeah, I don't believe in any of that. I don't believe that they're talking to the dead.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to one of these women, and she said to me, she basically told me that my dead dad was sitting beside me. And I burst into tears, and I couldn't stop crying for half an hour, despite the fact that I didn't believe her at all. And I thought, well, you know what? If that works as therapy, that was like 7 years worth of therapy in 45 minutes, and it only cost me $60.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with that?
Well, which gets to so much of this book, that story, it seems to me, which is this kind of agnosticism you have about, is this real or is this not real? You know it's not real, but you're willing to imagine that it has the power of the real.
Yes, absolutely. And back to the dual part structure that you were talking about.
Yeah.
That was always my hope with the book, that I could argue both for belief on one side and against belief on the other side and never have to prove either and only just allow it to be a question that would stand for the reader, you know, to arrive at your own answer.
Well, at one point, the boy, Nat, who was the great talker to the dead, tells a disbeliever, I don't believe it, but that doesn't stop it from happening.
Absolutely. And I mean, and back to this idea of the power of fiction that affects me every single day, it's the same with the power of the dead in our lives, too. Do I believe that ghosts come and hide under my bed and jump out and say, boo? I do not. I know a lot of people who do, and I believe their belief, but it doesn't stop the dead person from affecting me every single day.
Sure.
So they don't exist. That doesn't matter to me. So these people are con artists. It doesn't matter to me. What they do still affects me. The books that I read still affect me. And I'm that's the kind of magic power that I'm talking about here, being affected by things that don't exist.
Right.
I mean, and I'm also interested in this idea that unexplainable things happen and some people in my life try to convince me that they didn't happen and some people, you know, just nod their head and
you mean things that happened to you?
Things that have happened, yes.
And like, give me an example of the most extreme.
Okay.
Whoa.
Okay.
One.
All right. One of my daughters, 3 years old, we drove by the site where someone had died in a car crash, and there was a memorial, and the cross said Billy. My daughter did not read at this point, and she looked at it. And she said, my other daughter said, what's that? And I hesitated because I didn't want to tell a sad story to them. And in my hesitation, my tiny daughter who didn't read said, that's where William died. I don't even know what to do with that.
Cast the demons out.
I don't even know what
Cast
to do.
Cast the devil out of her, Samantha.
Not Billy, as the sign said. So even if she could read,
yeah,
which she couldn't.
Yeah.
She called him William.
Is she a genius today?
And I said, I asked her, she's still only five, oh, but I asked her, I said, after I kind of recovered from the shock, and my husband was in the car too, so I have witnesses, you know, that I'm not an insane person. And I asked her how she knew that, and she said that the robot in her head told her.
And really, I know this wasn't a trick that your husband pulled by telling her earlier just to freak you out?
No, it was at a place that we'd not been.
Well, there you go. You go. That's a mystery.
And so I'm interested in that, yeah, how we live with mysteries and how we just kind of say, okay, I'm just going to abide by that.
Yeah. This novel, among all three of yours, it seemed to me, because it has magic, it has suspense, it has these great characters, it is a mystery that one doesn't see the end coming, seems like a great movie or even better, like HBO series.
Ooh, fingers crossed. I hope so.
Or is there a talk?
There is talk. Yep. There's been some, I mean, just in the early days. It only came out a few days ago, but hopefully, yes.
Well, good luck on that. I'll watch.
Thank you.
Sam, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Splitfoot is out right now. You think you know what you like. You're a romantic comedy nut, or you're a video gamer, or you're a nonfiction person. But sometimes fate kind of reshuffles that deck. When Julia Wirtz was growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, she was a reader, a big reader, and she mostly read fantasy books.
My mom would take us to the library book sale every first Wednesday of every month, and my brother and I would get big trash bags full of books and then just spend hours locking myself in my bedroom and reading the Chronicles of Narnia, and all of the Oz books were my favorite.
So reading was a huge part of Julia's life until she was 19, which is when something strange started happening.
I started getting fevers, losing a bunch of weight. My joints were really painful. I couldn't walk after a while, and eventually I just couldn't even get out of bed. So I was going to the doctor, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong. They're running all these tests. Took them about 6 months to diagnose me with systemic lupus, which is an autoimmune disease, so I had to go on a lot of medication. You know how sometimes the cure is worse than the actual disease. One of the side effects of the medication I was on was that I couldn't focus because it was making me physically ill, because if I looked at text, it would get all wobbly.
Now, suddenly, the thing that Julia had relied on for years as her refuge was off limits. But she still found herself going to the library.
So I was at the San Francisco Public Library, and I was looking for things that didn't have fine print. And I picked up, I think, some audiobooks and some videos. And then on the way out, I saw a very small shelf, actually, and it had some graphic novels on it. And I just kind of grabbed them on a whim. I just looked at them and I was like, oh, there's pictures and I don't have to focus and I can handle this. One of them was My New York Diary by Julie Doucet. My New York Diary is basically about her moving to New York and just going to some parties, kind of some relationship stuff. She's very messy, so she's kind of surrounded in her own squalor. And it's just a picture into her life at that time. There's a lot of personality to it. She's a very clear style, and it's just black and white. There's no color, and it's just her sort of frazzled character. It's very unique. It's just very much her. When you're looking at a graphic novel, there's the top narrative, there's the dialogue, and there's the visual. So there's three layers of it that I had no idea could connect all together to tell an actual story. The narrative and the visual going together, which I hadn't realized could happen outside of the Sunday comics. And, I mean, it was the opposite effect of not focusing on anything. I'd, like, zeroed in on one, like, laser precision, and I've never been like that with anything. It was winter. I think I had just turned 21. I was really sick. I had been in bed for days. And I opened Julie's My New York Diary, and she's just sitting there at her drawing desk or sitting on the bed, and her room's a mess. There's, you know, like bowls and cups and socks and books and art things, and it's all over her room. And I looked at that drawing and just kind of like looked around at my apartment, and it was the exact same thing. It was a mirror image of what I was seeing on the paper. And I just thought, you know, if she can draw her room and make it a thing and put it on paper and make it into a book that everyone can look at, I can do that too. Like, if she can do it, I can do it. So then I did, and I just drew my room, and that was one of the first drawings I ever did. Now I'm a cartoonist, and I've had 5 books published, and I've been nominated for 2 Eisner Awards. Aesthetically, I never went to art school, and you can really tell, but I think that the uninformed sort of raw aesthetic of it really works, because it's just, here's my life, I'm a very simple person, and then here's a very simple way of drawing that. So I don't get too fancy, because I want to present just like the every person story. I like to write and I like to draw, and I couldn't do either of them well. But when I put them together on paper, and I don't want to be pompous enough to say I do it well, but I mean, apparently I'm passable at it. So It just made sense to me. If I have three pages of a short story and I'm forced to put it into six panels of a comic, it naturally edits itself. You have to pick out the most essential sentence, and then you use the art to fill in the blanks. Once I'm forced to put it in boxes, it just makes sense.
Julia Wirtz is the author of Museum of Mistakes, and you can also see her work on The New Yorker's website. Scott Ross produced our story with help from Josh Rogerson. Is there some book or song or video game or TV show or any other work of culture that changed your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might put your story on the air. Coming up, the history of American pop music runs directly through Cuba. But until just recently, of course, American musicians couldn't really get there.
I was always aware that there was a very deep historical relationship between Cuba and New Orleans, but none of us have ever been here before.
The Preservation Hall Jazz Band finally goes to Havana. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. Okay, I am now a GIF convert. GIFs are, of course, those super short, repeating videos people pass around online. The one of Lady Gaga bumping Leonardo DiCaprio at the Golden Globes completely convinced me. You can see it at studio360.org. Anyhow, GIFs are a currency of our age and the currency of our latest listener challenge. We want you to make a Valentine gift for somebody in your life. It can be someone who makes you swoon, somebody who makes you a latte every day, or your coworker who's always perfectly chill. If you're worried you've never made a gift, you're not alone. Me neither. And since I want to make one for some special people in my life, I called in an expert to teach me how. Tyler Menzel is the editorial director of Giphy.com, which runs a search engine for finding GIFs and has tools to make them. Tyler, thank you for coming in.
You're welcome. Of course.
I want to make one for my daughters, Kate and Lucy. And one family joke that I thought of that could maybe be incorporated in this is I and they joke about which one of them I love more. I had thought that maybe that could be part of it. Let's figure out what I need to do this.
So the first step is you need something to work with, either a video or a couple stills.
I, knowing that you were going to come in and we were going to figure this out, made a little video of my desk and office at home that I knew they would recognize so that I wouldn't have to put my own stupid face in it, but that they would see that it was from me. And I'll show it to you.
Great.
I just went back and forth between my desktop computer and the window of my office.
Absolutely. This is wonderful. This is great. It's everything that really works well. And if it's short, and that gets the point across instantaneously, which is wonderful.
Well, great. So take me through this. So I have made this little video with my iPhone, which I think anyone can do.
So do you have the Giphy Cam app? Okay, perfect. So you open it up, go to the little camera roll button there.
Yeah.
So you can see that since the video.
Oh, wow, it's already there.
Yeah, since the video you took was the last one, it automatically grabbed it and started playing it. Then you can play around with the video. You can shorten it a little bit if you want to, or you can add some effects. We could put some hearts on there if you scroll down.
Are there a variety of hearts? Are they under a heart section here?
So there's two different things you could do. Uh-huh. There's one heart section where it actually takes out like a green screen. It takes out a piece of the background and we'll do almost a green screen effect. If you click that.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is like some little Giphy, I've dropped acid version of a Valentine, because there's this sort of cool rainbow psychedelic heart that is interwoven with the reality of my office.
Do you want to add any text?
Yeah, I think text. I was thinking text, which is I love you the best. And then I'll send it to both of them, and that will be the joke. They won't know which one.
I love it. I love it.
Okay.
So you can pick a few different kinds of fonts.
Of course, whichever
font you think fits the mood the best.
I'm going to go with a relatively discreet one. Okay. I have typed in, I love you the best, with you in all caps.
So you just created a GIF.
And I truly am impressed. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. This was so much fun.
Tyler Menzel is the editorial director of Giphy.com. You can find out all the details about entering our challenge and see the GIF that I made at studio360.org/GIF, G-I-F. Your Valentines are due here by midnight on February 1st. Our judges for this challenge are Heaven Nigatu and Tracy Clayton, who are hosts of the great podcast Another Round.
Be our Giphy Valentine.
She means Giphy Valentine.
Once upon a time, boats sailed between New Orleans and Havana twice a day. And those ferries helped connect the city's fabulous music scenes until the U.S. embargo came along in the early 1960s and cut that connection. At around the same time, a group in New Orleans had formed to help keep that city's unique flavor of jazz alive. The Preservation Hall Jazz Band has been playing ever since.
My name is Charlie Gabriel, and I'm the clarinetist and saxophonist with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band from New Orleans. I started playing jazz in 1943 in New Orleans. I'm 11 years old.
I am Ben Jaffe. I play bass with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. I was always aware that there was a very deep historical relationship between Cuba and New Orleans.
In 1956, a friend of mine named James Gidding, he was working down in Motown playing vibes and trumpet and piano. So we were supposed to come to Cuba, and we made big preparation to come. And at the last minute, I got a job. I said, well, look, baby, I don't think I'm going to make it. So it was my dream to get to Cuba before I leave this universe.
As travel restrictions to Cuba were suddenly relaxing, the seven members decided it was time to make this musical pilgrimage south.
Bienvenidos a La Habana, Cuba.
The first performance we did here in Cuba was at the Mayes Theater.
And over the past 2 years, we've been working on a way to get the Preservation Hall Jazz Band to La Habana.
The Teatro Maya is where all the jazz musicians like to play. We performed with Hernan Lopez Nusa, who's an incredibly gifted musician from one of the great Cuban musical families. When Hernan visited, he was playing something on the piano, and I said, oh, that sounds like ragtime. And he said, no, this is a danzón. And I got our piano player, Ricky Monet, to play an old ragtime composition, and Hernan listened to the piece. He goes, oh, no, he said, this is a danzón. I said, no, this is ragtime. Hernan took this as an opportunity to compose a song that explores these places where the musics, you know, kind of kiss each other.
The rhythm is Africa, and the melody is Spanish. And all the rhythm and thing that you usually hear, bolero, cha-cha, tango, ragtime, and Afro-Cuban music, all of that is habanero music. So this music, as it moves around the universe, it does something to the people, and the people does something to the music.
We also got permission to play an outdoor public concert in the historic district of Old Havana. And we took over a tiny square and a pedestrian block. This is something that is fairly commonplace for us to do in New Orleans. The tradition is people march with the parade. They are the parade, really, with the band.
I was so happy to see them join in. I would think that would be about the first time they were exposed to an American concept of a second line. So all we had to do was play the music lively, and everybody started to dance and love it. I'm playing my horn trying to do that. They get right inside the band, and basically you're supposed to go behind the band. The band's supposed to be in front. You can second line all on the side of the band, all behind the band, but not inside the band. They were knocking me down. Well, they didn't know. So they just doing what they felt. So I just enjoyed it. I really did.
We've encountered musicians from all walks of life, you know, from these jazz elite artists to, you know, drummers whose ancestry goes back to the Congo. You have all of these musicians living side by side, impacting one another. You can't ignore the sounds of the drum. You know, you can't ignore the rhythms of life here. Everywhere we go, we're greeted with, you know, my brother, like New Orleans, music is in the womb.
Now I am very pleased I made this journey. It's been a wonderful experience, and really, it has really completed my dream. But that doesn't mean I want to leave now. I still want to live long.
That's the Preservation Hall Jazz Band performing in Havana. You can see some photos of them there at studio360.org. Thanks to Marissa Neff for bringing us that story. Still ahead this hour, how to write fun, catchy songs about unlikely subjects. And I mean extremely unlikely subjects.
Well, here's what I know about Michelangelo. He painted on the ceiling and he carved up some stones. He built some beautiful library stairs and he gave St. Peter a dome.
Walter Martin explains his eccentric fixation. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. A lot of kids jam with their friends in high school, but not many of them become actual sensations. The five guys in the Walkmen grew up together in Washington, D.C. As the Walkmen, their songs stood out for the jangly piano and guitars and the voice of their lead singer, Hamilton Lighthouser. Then in 2013, after making music together for most of their lives, they called it quits. But your band dissolving doesn't mean you totally switch gears and become, I don't know, a gym teacher. Walter Martin, who played organ and bass and wrote songs for the band, now has his own record out this month called Arts and Leisure, and he is with me now in the studio. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
So this record is, we're treating it as though it's your first solo album. And it kind of sort of is, but you had another solo record last year, a kids record, yeah?
Yeah, the first thing I did was a kids record. I sort of I wanted to do something very different, so I like to have a specific assignment. So I assigned myself to make a sort of my fantasy kids record, how I'd imagine a very fun, charming, sweet kids record. So it was just a way to just sort of clear everything out. It was, and I had a hell of a lot of fun doing it.
And you found your authentic songwriting voice by making that left turn?
Yeah, I did. I listened back and I thought that I sounded like myself. I remember playing it for my mom, actually, for the first time. And she, you know, playing her silly song about, like, the zoo or something. And she sort of, like, cried. She was like, oh, it's Walter. It's Walter. and, you know, it made me feel good. I was like, okay, this really is, feels authentically like me on there. So I was happy about that.
As opposed to songs you'd written, say, for the Walkman that were trying to do something else?
Well, I mean, when it's a collaborative thing, it's more, you're sort of creating, I think, like, sort of a collective personality. And I'm not necessarily expressing, when in writing lyrics for the Walkman, I wasn't really necessarily trying to say, express myself so much. We're sort of more creating something, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Whereas when I do my own stuff, it's really, I'm desperately trying to just be, you know, I'd never really done that before, try to just be myself entirely.
I get the assignment aspect of, oh, a kid's album. And of course, that's a genre. So the whole, it has a commercial possibility and all that. In this age where the concept album is dead, you've taken it, been even more perverse. Like, okay, maybe it's dead. Well, I'm going to do it about artists. I mean, that seems extreme.
I know. My first instinct was that it sounded funny to me. I actually remember sitting in my living
yeah.
room and, like, looking at, I have sort of a collection of art books and things like that in my living room. And I was like, maybe it'd be funny to write about artists, art history. And it struck me as funny. And when I told people, they'd be like, oh, that's funny. And so I was like, oh, I like this. This is funny. I mean, I have a lot of ideas I think are funny, and a lot of them, nothing happens with them.
Right.
But I started writing songs for it, and I started realizing that I could make them kind of what I could, that I, you know, that I could draw in how much I like art and
yeah.
certain artists I like, certain ideas. So I really could put some real feeling into it. So it started really adding up to something that I thought was kind of cool.
May we hear one of these songs to start?
Yes. I'm going to do the jobs I had before I got rich and famous.
Oh, great. Song. And then we can talk about it.
Okay. Mowing lawns, saving up for a guitar when I was 15, and long and lean, just like that grass, boy, I was green. Delivering roses in Washington, D.C., going off to college, so I had to save up. But delivering roses really sucks. Sweating all summer in a slimy tux, but at least I made a couple bucks. Freshman in college, I was delivering pizza, but to deliver one pie was a half an hour round trip. And college kids, man, they don't tip. And so I quit, and it was their loss, 'cause I was the only driver not stealing from the boss and siphoning gas from students' cars. Metropolitan Museum at the telephone switchboard, when a caller would ask for Philippe de Montebello, I'd transfer it to my apartment where an unsuspecting fellow, my roommate Stuart, would be sound asleep. He'd answer the phone when he heard the beep, and pretty quickly he'd realize that he wasn't Philippe. Information counter at the Cloisters Museum, and one day Billy Joel walks in. I take a long, long look at him, a dignified old music man, and that's when I devised my plan. And that little plan has brought me here, where the spotlight shines and the people all cheer, and the pretty girls flock from far and near to touch my hand and hear my songs and buy my t-shirts and sing along. God damn, this sure beats mowing lawns.
That was excellent. That was Walter Martin playing Jobs I Had Before I Got Rich and Famous off his new album, Arts and Leisure. This record, I mean, that's a fun and funny song, as are many and most of the songs on this record. I mean, this is obviously a very different kind of music than you did in the Walkman.
Yeah, it's entirely different.
I mean, did you know you had this, like, whistling folky guy in you?
Yeah, I did. Definitely. Yeah. Because a lot of times when I was doing Walkman words, I would write sort of whistling guy dopey songs just to get words going, just so I have words that I could then transfer to a different kind of song.
Uh-huh.
I guess there's a part of me that always felt like having too much humor in music is bad. And I think that often that's true. There's not very much humorous music that I think I like very much.
Randy Newman?
I love Randy Newman. I mean, he's my hero entirely. So then suddenly, I guess it was really when I had kids, I felt like, you know, this is sort of what naturally comes out of me. If I do believe in it, yeah. So I should probably just do it.
The collection of artists on this record, in fact, are incredibly eclectic. Couldn't be more so. Including, as you've said, the, quote, first rock and roll song ever written about American portrait painter John Singleton Copley and the first shuffle ever written about Scottish designer Charles Rennie Mackintosh. how did you decide on, first of all, who you were going to include? Are these your favorites?
No, they're not necessarily my favorites. I wanted to make sure they're all people that I really loved and that I had some sort of real emotional attachment to that I could, you know, tap into. I like writing about John Singleton Copley because I was like the humble portrait painter kind of character, and sort of it's just such a probably like the least flashy, sexy thing you can write about is like a dusty old American portrait painter. For some reason, it just felt funny. Like the idea of writing a song, it just felt funny to me. And then I started putting it together, and
that's why you made it a rock song too.
That's why I put a beat on it. I don't know. I have no idea. But all these little decisions happen, and then suddenly I have this song. And then sometimes I do. All these decisions happen, and I have a song, and then I'm like, okay, that's really just no good. But I liked the Copley one, so I kept it.
And so you grew up in Washington. Was there a lot of Copley in your childhood?
No, not really. I just remember it for some reason I liked it. I remember like in high school that I liked it. And I remember being sort of proud of myself for liking it because it's such a. Not that he's boring, but there's nothing that it's not
official
like,
it's and formal, and,
right?
Yeah,
exactly.
All that. Yeah. You in the Walkman, you played organ, you played bass, you wrote songs. Here you are singing and playing guitar. Were those skills you've always had, or and just the band wouldn't let you do them, or are they new things?
Singing, I don't really consider a skill. I mean, I definitely don't fancy myself a real vocalist. I sort of think of myself as the only person who will sing my song, so I have to do it.
Yeah.
And guitar, yeah. I mean, I played guitar when I was, it was my first instrument. I think most people who have been in bands forever.
Can do everything.
I mean, really.
Whistle? Have you always been a whistler?
I actually have always been a whistler. So I just started, you know, I didn't want to do the thing where you have a solo verse and play harmonica, so I figured I would just whistle. So I do a lot of whistling.
Yeah, the solo verse playing harmonica would then be too, retro 1962, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
May we hear another of the songs off of Arts and Leisure?
Sure. Yeah, I'm going to do Michelangelo.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, here's what I know about Michelangelo. He painted on the ceiling and he carved up some stones. He built some beautiful library stairs and he gave St. Peter a dome. He left Moses sitting in Rome. Well, I wonder how I can be more like him. But where I see a cracked ceiling, he sees the birth of man. Mama said I ought to sit down and put together some sort of plan. 'Cause that's how Michelangelo began. He'd go down to his studio. He'd wait till the ideas flowed. He'd take out his hammer and spike. He'd chip at that marble until the marble looked right. And he'd say, oh, 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 oh.
Whoa, oh, oh, that's why they call me Michelangelo. Well, let's not forget about the sculpture of David. If the earth washed away, well, that's one thing worth saving. His eyes are scared and sad, and at the same time, they're strong and brave. He put Goliath down in his grave. And he'd go down to his studio. He'd wait till the ideas flowed. He'd take out his hammer and spike. He'd chip at that marble until the marble looked right. And he'd say, oh, 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 oh. Whoa, oh, oh, that's why they call me Michelangelo. And that's all I know about Michelangelo. Yeah, that's all I know about Michelangelo.
Yay! That was Walter Martin playing Michelangelo off his new record, Arts and Leisure. The Walkmen have been in, I guess, suspended animation for a couple of years, but some of your bandmates played on this album and on your kids' album as well. Is revivifying the band something that you would like to happen?
I don't know. I mean, not right now. I'm really enjoying just doing what I'm doing right now. Who knows what'll happen, though? You know, at some point we might do it. But right now, I think when there's a great reason to do it, if we're all in the mood to do it and the stars align, maybe we'll do it. But who knows?
This is working out okay?
Yeah, I'm having a lot. I really, really love doing this. So we'll see.
Good. So before we go, Walter, what song from the record should we go out on so listeners can hear what these songs sound like when not played acoustically by you alone?
Probably this one, Down by the Singing Sea, which is very, it's much more about the music and less about the words.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Walter, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Walter Martin's Arts and Leisure is out at the end of this month. And you can hear another song that Walter played for us here about Dutch painters in Amsterdam at studio360.org. And that is now it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening.
Fish are jumping, guess they're hunting, they're right over there, there's a fly or something, down by the singing sea.
We're only on the radio when we're on the radio, but we're always on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Studio 360 Show, and I'm at KB Anderson. That's with an E-N. And if you like the show, you can help with its proper care and feeding by leaving us a review on iTunes. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yelody,
Kate Essex,
Zakia Gibbons.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegel.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
This should be a book that's read every 5 years because it's like food, man. It ain't McDonald's, man. The autobiography of Malcolm X is sit down, say grace, and eat your food very slowly as we sit around this table and do it.
Public Enemy's Chuck D on the autobiography of Malcolm X. That's next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.